Right, so can we turn in our Bibles to Revelation chapter 8? Revelation chapter 8, I'm going to read Revelation chapter 8 and then Revelation chapter 9 down to verse 12. So it says, "When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of the water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. Then the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. And I looked, and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who were about to sound.' Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the earth were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green thing, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days men will seek death, and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. The shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots, with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months, and they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. One war is past. Behold, still two more wars are coming after these things." So, if this is all getting a bit doom and gloom and terrifying, then don't forget you asked me to do it before we started. And we've reached this point, and it really is the point in time that Jesus in Matthew 24 verse 21 described as the worst of times. There has never been a time like it before, and never will there be again, the Lord Jesus himself said. So there's no way of glossing over this. There's no way of making this sound like something nice, because it isn't nice at all. Now, obviously, last week's Bible study had to be scrapped as far as the website is concerned. So for the sake of this series of Bible studies, as it appears on our website, because I know there are some people who follow this who don't come along, I just need to recap briefly on some of the things that we spoke about in last week's Bible study, before I get into what I'm going to speak on tonight, which is mainly from chapter 9. So what we're looking at here in chapters 8 and 9 are the so-called trumpet judgments. As far as the seal judgments are concerned, that began in chapter 6, the seventh seal, which is what we've come to, verse 1 of chapter 8, when he opened the seventh seal, the seventh seal consists of the seven trumpets and the seven bowl judgments. This is the seventh seal, or I should say they are. The seven trumpets and the seven bowl judgments are the seventh seal. And I illustrated that, if you remember, those who've been coming a long time, I gave you a kind of scroll with all the seals and that was kind of illustrated by that. So this is the seventh seal. The seven trumpets are the seventh seal. And as far as the timing of these events is concerned, all of this happens during the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. That time, as I said, Jesus referred to as the worst of all times. Now, in chapter 8, verse 1, the Apostle John says that when the seventh seal was opened, there was silence in heaven for about 30 minutes, which is a rather perplexing statement, really, since, as I understand it, there is no time in heaven. So I suggested to you last week that timing of that this kind of 30 minutes or short period of time is felt and experienced on earth, but the reason for it emanates out of heaven. In heaven, we're told there in the first few verses of chapter 8, the angels of God are preparing to unleash the final judgments of God upon the earth at that point in time. On earth, it is the silence of dread anticipation. I was actually, when I was preparing this Bible study, I was reminded of those verses in Luke's Gospel and chapter 1, where it says in verse 25, there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Men's hearts failing them. Fear and expectation of the things that are coming upon the earth. And here you've got this silence. It's kind of the proverbial calm before the storm. Following the great earthquake and volcanoes and tsunamis that occurred when the sixth seal was opened, back in chapter 6, verses 12 to 17, and before volcanic activity, freak weather conditions, eruption of some volcanic island or islands, meteorites smashing into the earth, and the effects of all that on the seas, on the rivers, on sea creatures, on shipping, and on vegetation, that all these things which happen when the first four trumpet judgments come, in between, there's this short period of silence, this dead calm. And then, it tells us, as a prelude to the trumpet judgments, there are noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake, chapter 8, verse 5. In other words, these are horrendous freak weather conditions that often are associated with volcanic activity and earthquakes. You often get freak weather conditions, and that, it seems to me, is what's described there. And then, as the first angel sounded his trumpet, in verse 7, it says, hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. And it seems to me that what is described here is massive volcanic activity, possibly in various locations scattered around the globe, considering the extent of devastation that comes from it. Did you get that? It says, a third of the trees were burned up. So it's a third of vegetation is burned up. So I'm saying massive volcanic activity all over the world, given the devastation. And then it says, when the second angel sounded, in verse 8 and 9, a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And possibly that's a volcanic island or volcanic islands like Krakatoa in 1883 or Thera back in the time of, I think that was back in the time of Moses. There were volcanic islands that erupted, and it was almost as it were a mountain dissolving into the sea. And as a result of that, massive tsunamis are created, And what is described there, the effect of that, is that it kills a third of sea creatures and destroys a third of shipping. And then it says, when the third angel sounded his trumpet, a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. And I put it to you last week that that's possibly a huge asteroid or meteorite. And I read to you an article that described the sort of devastation that would occur if a meteorite 10 kilometres in diameter smashed to the earth. And basically what happens, and it doesn't have to be that big actually, a 1 kilometre diameter meteorite, what happens is as it crashes into the earth, it throws up rocks and debris and billions of particles, not just into the atmosphere, but into the stratosphere beyond, that ultimately blocks out the sun, but ultimately it rains back down upon the earth, polluting the rivers and the streams. And it says here a third of drinking water becomes bitter, polluted and undrinkable, and people even die from that. I would suggest it's either a meteorite or possibly massive nuclear strike, creating radioactive fallout that contaminates the water source, the drinking source of water. And then when the fourth angel sounded, verse 12, it says a third of the sun, moon and stars were struck, so that the skies were darkened and light blocked out. And again, you know, clearly that is created by the smoke and dust and debris thrown into the atmosphere and stratosphere from the volcanoes and from the dust and debris of the meteorite attack. Okay, all makes sense. It all fits in. Really, it's just on a massive, massive scale. And if anybody's interested, you just go on and Google it. You know, what would happen if a 1 kilometre meteorite hit the Earth? Explain, you know, put it Google, you know, what happens when volcanoes explode, and you get all the science of it there. It tells you what comes out, it tells you how it affects, you know, the atmosphere and everything else. It's all there. You just got to Google that. So, in other words, and that's kind of in a nutshell what we were looking at last week, things are going to get bad then. That statement of Jesus, there's never been a time like it before since man was on the earth, nor ever will be again, isn't an understatement. This is for real. And again, you know, if you accept the Bible as truth, and I do, this is not if, maybe, this is when. Because it is going to happen. And as we're thinking about it, it struck me, you know, that there may have been a time when people would have found it very difficult to imagine disaster and devastation on this kind of a scale. But I don't think that's the case anymore, certainly for us here in the West. I mean, for a start off, we, too often to be honest with you, we see items on the news, don't we, when maybe a big earthquake hit somewhere. Remember the earthquake that hit Haiti a few years ago? And I mean, you saw the devastation after that was just incredible. And then was it back in 2001, the Indonesian tsunami? Do you remember that? Terrible. You know, I think over 2,000-3,000 people died in that. Whole villages were just wiped out in virtual instant, you know. And so we see things like that on the television, on the news, and it's for real. You know, we know it's really happened. It may be localized, you know, in relation to what we're reading here, which is more on a global scale, but we're familiar with it anyway. And then, of course, there's the documentaries. I don't know if anybody ever watches the documentaries. You know, there's documentaries coming about freak weather conditions and there's documentaries about this and that. And you sometimes see them and you think, man, you know, I once was sitting with somebody who visited and he had this, he showed me this documentary he'd taped. And it was on about what happens when the Pacific plate shifts to the North American, moves against the North American plate and what will actually happen. And it's just unbelievable, the devastation that will be caused. And so we see these documentaries and we're aware of some of the facts, even if we're not scientists and geologists. And then of course there are the Hollywood blockbuster movies, the disaster movies. And I know it's fiction, okay, but the other, we watch this film, I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, 2012. And Now, listen, this is my disclaimer. I am not recommending it, okay? I'm not recommending it. And if you know anything about the film, you will know that the idea of the storyline is based on the unbiblical Mayan prophecy. That there's this Mayan prophecy predicted that the end of the world will be in 2012, or at least that's how people interpret the thing. So I think the world was supposed to come to an end on the 21st of December, if my memory serves me right, 2012. That's the Mayan prophecy. So the storyline is loosely based on that. And again, I'm not recommending the film, as all these Hollywood films, there's the odd profanity in it, you know, and I wouldn't want to recommend all of that. And it's not based on the Bible, although I will say they've borrowed a few ideas from the Bible, especially when you get to the end. They have borrowed a couple of ideas, but it's not biblical. But what I would say is this: if you've ever seen that film, the special effects are incredible. And how it depicts the devastation of cities, and when earthquakes strike and the city turning upside down, and how it depicts all that, and the tsunamis that come, I think depicts what we're reading here as well as you will find anywhere. No, it's a story, I know, it's just a film, but it's depicting what really will happen here when it describes the devastation caused, you see. So we've seen some of those films, and we also hear the talk of those scientists and politicians and Greenpeace and all these sorts of people who believe in the climate change idea, that climate change is caused by man's, gases burning fossil fuels and all the rest of it, and the idea is, you know, of what climate change is going to do, and we see some of their predictions, so we're aware of all these things. My point is, the things described here are not beyond the scope of people's imagination nowadays. In fact, one could be forgiven for thinking people today are actually being prepared for this in their minds. So when it does come, they'll be ready to unite together for the sake of the survival of the human race under the leadership of the man with the plan. Because that's invariably what happens in the blockbuster movies. They send Bruce Willis in, or somebody like that, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, or somebody comes along. It's always a man who works out, you know, and has muscles in his arms as big as my waist. You know, it's always somebody like that, or it's the President of the United States of America. He gets the world together, doesn't he, you know, and they all fight against the space aliens or the natural disaster or the comet or whatever's coming, and they win through in the end, you know. And so maybe, I don't know, people's minds are kind of being prepared for this. When it comes to, say, it's natural disasters or whatever, although chapter 6, verses 16 and 17, really they know the truth. They know it's the judgment of God. But if what happens through these first four trumpet judgments is bad, the worst is still to come. And whether or not they regard the events of the first four trumpet judgments to be natural disasters or not, they will not be able to say that about the fifth. But just before we come to that, let's just look at verse 13 of chapter 8. I looked and I heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." So, it says here, an angel. He saw an angel flying through the midst. If you've got a Bible with footnotes, you might have a little asterisk next to angel or a footnote saying that some texts read eagle. I'm going with the angel because the ancient text that the traditional interpretations of the Bible, King James and New King James Version, those translations go with the traditional manuscripts. The ones that have eagle, let's not go, that's a different Bible study, but I'm going with the original that says angel. Okay, now you will probably know that the word angel, Greek angelos, really literally means messenger. You know, now, obviously, there are many places in the Bible where it has a specific and a technical meaning. It refers to those created beings, those spirit beings that God created, the angels, who are spirits. So it refers to them. They are the messengers of God. Although many of them have fallen and followed Satan in his rebellion, they're still created angels, but they've become demons and evil spirits and things now. But they're the created angels. But the word itself literally means messenger. And this angel, this messenger, it says, flies through the midst of heaven. So that is the sky. We're not talking about the heaven, the third heaven where God is. We're talking about the sky, the atmosphere. It flies through the heavens proclaiming a message understandable to the occupants of the earth at that time. And the message is war, war, war to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. So perhaps this is an angel of God, a spirit, a created angel, who flies through the heavens, as it were, proclaiming this message that people hear and people understand. That's one possibility. And take this or leave it, it's just an idea. But perhaps it's a message that is broadcast through the airwaves or via the internet from those who become believers in the earlier part of the tribulation, who through reading these scriptures know exactly what's coming next. Because angel is messenger, bringing a message. So I mean, it could be either. The point is it comes through the air, it comes through the airwaves, and everybody understands it. So either way, the message is clear. The message is from God, and it's a message of war. This message isn't the sort of peace and safety, all will be well, kind of message that comes usually from the false prophets. I mean, that was Jeremiah's problem, wasn't it? He was sent by God to call the people to repentance, to tell them that judgment is coming, lest you repent. And his problem was not just that people wouldn't listen. But the problem was, there's these other prophets, and they only ever say good things. Well, Luke, if you've got a problem, and one bloke here only tells you, it's all going to be well, it's all going to be good, I've heard from God. And the other person says, ooh, you've got a serious, serious situation, you need to do X, Y, and Z. And the other person says, no, all will be well. Just keep smiling. God's going to give you his peace. Everything's going to be well. It's all going to be... Who do you want to listen to? You don't want to listen to the bloke who's telling you the nice message, aren't you? That's what you're going to want to listen to. And this is what Jeremiah found. And the Lord said this to him, chapter 6, verse 14. Verse 13. From the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have also healed the hurt of my people slightly, saying peace, peace, when there is no peace. In other words, there's a real problem here. But what the false prophets do is they stick a band-aid on it and say, oh, but you'll be all right. But Jeremiah's saying, no, there needs to be serious surgery here. There needs to be repentance. There needs to be a cutting away of that sin, a separating yourself from it. But the false prophets are saying, stick a band-aid on it, be all right. And then chapter 14, it's all through Jeremiah this. I really feel sorry for Jeremiah, but what a ministry that man had. What a hard ministry he had to bear, and sometimes he could hardly bear it. Chapter 14, verse 13. Then I said, Ah, Lord God, behold, the prophets say to them, You shall not see the sword, nor shall you have famine, but I will give you assured peace in this place. And the Lord said to me, The prophets prophesy lies in my name. I have not sent them, commanded them, nor spoken to them. They prophesy to you a false vision, divination, a worthless thing, and the deceit of their own heart. Still happening in the church today. Still happening. That's it. But what we have here in Revelation, in our passage, is not that kind of peace and safety message. The message that comes, whether it's an angel of God or whether it's from the believers via the airwaves or the internet, it's war. And war means grief, extreme sorrow. Grief, 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 because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. That's the message. Then, chapter 9, verse 1, it says, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. Now, as I've pointed out before, personally, I'm speaking for myself now, I follow the literal, grammatical, historical method of interpreting the scriptures. Now, in essence, what that means, to put it simply, is you take the scriptures literally, bearing in mind things like language, idiom, genre of the book or the section written, and the historical setting of the passage, and you take the scriptures literally unless there are obvious reasons why you shouldn't. Unless there are obvious reasons why it should be interpreted a different way, say metaphorically or allegorically or symbolically. I take it literally, unless there's good reason not to. Take this word star, for example, in chapter 9, verse 1. See, in our studies in the book of Revelation, we've come across the word star or stars several times. And sometimes the word is used in a literal sense, describing stars in the sky, or things that look like stars that sometimes fall down to earth. So, for example, in chapter 6, you have that in verse 12. I looked, and he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black, the sackcloth and her, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to earth as fig trees drop its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Now, obviously, they're not stars as in the sun is a star, but for all intents and purposes, to the eye, it looks like stars are falling from the sky. And probably that's the burning debris that's come out of a volcano, but it looks like stars falling down from the sky. So it can be literal like that. Or in chapter 8, verse 10, the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven burning like a torch. And I said earlier, that's probably a meteorite or something like that. It's not a star in the technical sense that the sun is a star, but something that, you know, a planetary orbits or whatever you want to call it, you know, a meteorite or an asteroid or something like that. So sometimes the word star is literal. But then other times the word star or stars is obviously used in a figurative sense. So for example, in chapter 1 and verse 20, it says, the mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. The messengers of the seven churches, we considered what that meant back at the beginning. And then in chapter 12, there's another one, and verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. And then in verse 4, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour the child. Now in all those instances, clearly they're figurative. And usually when something's figurative, the explanation for it is not too far away, or it's somewhere in the Bible. So in chapter 1, verse 20, it tells you. It says, this is the mystery of the seven stars. The seven stars are the messengers of the seven churches. It's figurative. It stands for something. They're either men or angels or whatever we looked at the time. And in verse 1 of chapter 12, that this woman appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Well, we looked at that a few weeks ago. It isn't the Roman Catholic Mary with the garland of 12 stars around her head. That's how the Roman Catholic Church interpreted it, but it isn't that at all. It's a reference to Genesis 37, where, you remember Joseph's dream, and he dreams his father and mother are the sun and the moon, and him and his brothers are the 12 stars, you see. And his brothers bow down to him, do you remember? And basically, it's simply identifying who the woman is here. It's Israel, you see. That's what that is. It's figurative. And then in verse 4, that's a reference to fallen angels who followed Satan in his rebellion. It says his tail, Satan's tail, drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them down to the earth. And they are the fallen angels who follow Satan in his rebellion, you see. So it's figurative. So when we come to chapter 9 and verse 1, we must ask ourselves, is this star a literal star, maybe an asteroid or a meteorite or something like that, or are we to understand it in a figurative sense, that is, representing someone or something? Let me read it again. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. Is it literal, a planet or a meteorite, or is it figurative? Does it represent someone or something? Well, to me, the answer is in the text. You see, if you look at chapter 8, verse 10, there is no reason whatsoever to see that as figurative. The second angel sounded, and something it's verse 10. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a... There's no reason to take that as figurative. It's literal. It's a meteorite or something like that coming burning down to earth. But here in chapter 9, you'll notice this star is personified. It says, to him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened. The star that came down to earth, to him was given. Clearly then, this is a person or a personality. It isn't simply a rock falling out of the sky. It's figurative, and it's figurative of a person. So who is it? Well, first of all, notice here, John at this point isn't seeing the star falling from heaven. He's seeing a star that has fallen from heaven. Fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven. It's not falling, it's fallen. Now, I'm not being pedantic or anything. This is important that we understand what this is or who this is if we're going to understand the passage at all. So if we want to know who this person is, who is represented by this star, I think we've got to turn again to chapter 12. And in chapter 12... it seems to me the details are given. You remember chapter 12 is one of the essential detail passages that explains things. So if we look at chapter 12 and verses 3 and 4, another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Verse 9. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Verse 12. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. War to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. It seems to me that the one who John refers to figuratively here as a star fallen from heaven is none other than the devil. It's Satan, if chapter 12 is referring to the same one. It's Satan. And the fall from heaven to which he refers here occurred, as we saw in a previous Bible study, somewhere around about the midpoint of the tribulation, when according to Revelation 12, he begins his all-out attack on God's people. And here in chapter 9, we see that to him is given the key to the bottomless pit, to the abyss, which he opens. And as he does so, it says smoke arises out of it like the smoke of a great furnace. So perhaps coinciding with this, there's another massive volcanic eruption. But be that as it may, out of the abyss, out of the bottomless pit, come swarms of what are described in verse 3 of chapter 9 as locusts. However, these are not locusts in the normal sense. That much is clear from what's described in verses 3 to 11. And besides, locusts don't live in the bottomless pit. Locusts dwell on earth. So what are these? Actually, if you look at the various writings of theologians and expositors of the scriptures down the centuries and people who write commentaries, there's loads of suggestions as to what or who these are. Here's a few. Heretics, Goths, Muslims, Saracens, Turks, Jesuits, Protestants, the list goes on and on and on as to what these locusts actually are. Yet it seems to me that to spiritualize this passage to the extent that you make this swarm of locust-like fiends with scorpion-like power, any of those things, Turks and Saracens and Protestants and Jesuits or whatever else, that strips the passage of its real and, I think, obvious meaning. If we take the passage at face value, it seems to me that what this describes is hordes of demons that swarm out of the abyss like a plague of locusts out of the bottomless pit. And they're likened to a swarm of locusts to give us some impression of just how many there are. There are millions of them, and they all come up from the bottomless pit. Or perhaps it's to put in mind that which was written in the book of the prophet Joel in the Old Testament. For example, in chapter 1, it says, verse 1, the word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel, hear this, you elders, and give ear, all you inhabitants of the land. Has anything like this happened in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? Tell your children about it. Let your children tell their children and their children another generation. What the chewing locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the crawling locust has eaten. And what the crawling locust left, the consuming locust has eaten. Awake, you drunkards, and weep, and wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine. For it has been cut off from your mouth. For a nation has come up against my land, strong and without number. His teeth are teeth of a lion, and he has fangs of a fierce lion. And then over into chapter 2, it says, blow the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming, for it is at hand, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, like the morning clouds spread over the mountains. A people come, great and strong, the like of whom has never been, nor will ever be any such after them, even for many successive generations. A fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them as a desolate wilderness. Surely nothing shall escape them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like swift steeds so they run, with a noise like chariots. Over the mountains they leap like the noise of a flaming fire that devours the stubble, like a strong people set in battle array. Before them the people writhe in pain. All faces are drained of colour. They run like mighty men. They climb the wall like men of war. Everyone marches in formation, and they do not break ranks. They do not push one another. Everyone marches in his own column. Though they lunge between the weapons, they are not cut down. They run to and fro in the city, they run on the wall, they climb into the houses, they enter into the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and moon grow dark, and the stars diminish their brightness. The Lord gives voice before his army, for his camp is very great. For strong is the one who executes his word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can endure it? And in the time of Joel, that was a swarm of locusts. But perhaps the full fulfillment of that prophecy is yet to come, and it's what we're reading about here in Revelation. And these are demon hordes that rise up from the abyss, and it seems to me they are possibly the ones that are currently held in chains of darkness in the bottomless pit, as it puts it in Jude and verse 6. The angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. And they held there in chains until the time when God, as it were, allows them to be released. He allows them to be released at this point in time, and he uses them to execute his judgment on an ungodly, unrepentant and wicked world. And so they come, swarming out of the bottomless pit like a plague of locusts. Only, whereas locusts would swarm over the vegetation and eat all that up, it tells us here that they do not touch the grass or the vegetation that's left from the burning volcanic sulfur that burned up a third of it. They don't touch any of that. These attack people. It says they're given power, like the scorpions of earth have power, to sting and inflict great pain on people for 5 months. Now, I'm not sure whether that means the plague of these tormenting demons continues for 5 months, or if it means the pain that they inflict lasts for 5 months. Actually, I read it, it turns out that the full cycle of a locust plague usually lasts for about 5 months. So perhaps it's the first suggestion. Perhaps this swarm of locusts, this plague of demon locusts, is actually around for about 5 months. But be that as it may, the pain they inflict is so intense that those who are affected by it want to die, assuming that death will bring them the release that they long for. But in the event, they won't be able to die. Death escapes them. They won't be allowed to die. So what do these demons look like? Well, obviously, demons, like angels, are spirits. And as spirits, would be invisible to the naked eye. Possibly there's angels all around us, but you don't see them unless, for some reason, God opens your eyes and you actually see that. But because they're spirits, they're in the spirit realm. So for that reason, some people think that maybe these will be invisible to the human eye. That here, John is kind of given a vision of what is happening in the spirit realm. So he sees them, and that's possible, of course. However, at the same time, we have to acknowledge that demons, like angels, can have form and appearance. They can manifest in a form and an appearance. And in that, John the Apostle, here in verse 7, talks about the shape and appearance of them, perhaps that suggests that these demons do manifest themselves in form. Look at verses 7 to 10. The shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. On the heads were crowns of something like gold, and the faces were like faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and the teeth were like lion's teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of the wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. Perhaps they manifest themselves. So what you've got to try and do is imagine what it will be like for the people on earth at that time, having suffered all they've already suffered, only to find next there are hordes of swarming demons like horses, these hideous beings all over the place. If Joel's prophecy comes into this, swarming up the walls, in through the windows, everywhere, all over them, stinging them with this sting that the pain is so intense, you want to die. Who wants to be around on earth then? Come on. Thank God the rapture comes first. Still, if this is so, and what I'm suggesting is a correct interpretation, God is using these to execute his judgment, that raises a kind of interesting question, I think. Why would God use such as these, the demons, to execute his righteous judgment on the unrepentant? Why would God do that? Well, before I answer that question, of course, let me just remind you of some of the things God used in the Old Testament to execute his judgment. Well, for a start off, you've got what happened in Egypt. You've got what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. And there's, you know, we read in Joel, locusts. God sent locusts. Why? God sometimes sent famine. Time of Elijah. Classic case. Why? And then there was the time, of course, Israel's enemies. God allowed Israel's enemies sometimes to attack them and to defeat them. Classic case, the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar came, invaded the country. Jeremiah had been warning them for years, but nobody had listened to him hardly. And then they came, and the city fell, and the temple was burned, and the people taken away into captivity. The Babylonians, they were pagan, idolatrous, monstrous people, really. An incredible thing about that, I digress, is God saved Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar became a convert. God humbled him before he did, but he did. There's the grace of God for you. But God sent the Babylonians. Why? But you see, you've got to understand the sin of Judah at the time. It was idolatry. They were constantly going after pagan idols the whole time. And so what God did in sending the Babylonians, he gave them a taste of their own medicine. He said, you want idols? I'll take you to the world's capital city of idolatry. You go into Babylon. And you can have a belly full of idols there. In other words, he gave them over to the very thing they'd lusted after for years. They were reaping what they'd sown. And I think it's the same here. God sends these demon hordes. He's giving people what they want. They're reaping what they've sown. You find that in Romans chapter 1. Therefore God gave them over to do this. Therefore God gave them over. Gives them over to the things that they lust after. Gives them what they want, in other words. So in closing, what do men sow to? What are men and women and boys and girls actually sowing into the hearts and minds more and more in these days? Violence, lust, perversion, occult stuff, spiritism, demonism. Consider the content of so many films and TV shows. Ever tried going buying a DVD in Tesco or somewhere? I mean, you're hard pushed to find anything that you would actually want to look at. There's so much occult, so much horror. I understand the marketing industry. Tesco don't sell it. Don't put it on the shelf unless it sells. If that stuff don't sell, they won't put it on the shelf. End off. If all people wanted was Snow White, then Snow White is all that would be on the shelf. So clearly what people want is Chainsaw Massacre and whatever else there is out there, whatever it's called. You know, that's the stuff people want, I guess. Yeah. I've mentioned many times in the past, because it's something I know something about. The fact is, if you knew what some of the content was and some of the themes in many rock records and albums and what certain rock bands are all about thoroughly, through and through, if you knew that, you'd be shocked. Some of it is demonic through and through, occult, right to the core. Or take the games people play on the computers and consoles, Xbox and all that. Virtual reality games in which you're interacting with monsters and demons, or role-playing games in which you actually take on the person and the character of a creature or a demon or a villain or a sorcerer or a knight or something else. And the thing about much of that stuff is it's sort of addictive, you know. It's addictive. You can't put it down. Well, I can't because I don't do computer games. But people who are into that just can't put it down. Hour upon hour upon hour. It draws you in. People, young kids and adults now, spend literally hours and hours on that stuff. What are they doing? They're sowing something into the heart and mind and the life. I'm not trying to be clever. I mean, it's obvious. It's a no-brainer. And the thing is this, you can't expect to sow all that stuff into your mind and life and it not have some effect. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not suggesting for one minute that everyone who does that turns out to be some kind of demon-possessed monster. I am not suggesting for one minute that everybody who is addicted to some of these violent games where you're shooting and cutting people up and all the rest of it turn into mass murderers. But some do. Some do. But here in Revelation, we're looking at the real end result. And God gives them over to that which they love. They want horror. They want demons. They want demonic things. God simply gives them over to it. He simply gives them what they wanted. But somebody might say, really, Ian, come on. I mean, the horror films, the demons, the monsters, the books, the games. It's just fantasy. It's just harmless fun, isn't it? Is it? It's from the pit. And from the pit, one day, it will rise up and bite them, according to this. And they will feel in themselves the pain and the torment they watched others suffer in the films that they watched and even inflicted on others in the virtual world that they live in. That's what you're doing. You're cutting people up in a virtual world. Only now, it'll be for real. And lastly, see, ordinary locusts don't have a king over them. But these do. He's called the angel of the bottomless pit. A fallen angel whose name in Hebrew, it says, is Abaddon. In Greek, he has the name Apollyon, which means the destroyer. War, war, war to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpets of these three angels who are about to sound. One very last thing, though. You'll notice that the demons have no power over those who have the seal of God on their forehead. They can't touch what belongs to God. God keeps his people safe from the demons, but the rest are open prey. I'm sorry if it's all doom and gloom, but you asked for it. This is the book of Revelation, and it seems to me this is what it means. Amen. Well, let's just have some prayer, shall we, before we close our meeting this evening.